We need to begin this evening by trying to define our terms and to make clear exactly what we mean when we nominate the sin of anger as the next of the seven deadly sins that we're going to deal with in these few weeks. For we need to be sure of the nature of this sin, what it is and what it is not, and what it is the opposite of, and what it is not the opposite of. The trouble is that the word anger is used in a variety of ways which must be distinguished. This is supposed to be the age, for example, of angry young men. Well, is this what we mean? Is it a good thing or a bad thing to be an angry young man? We read in the Gospels that on occasion Christ looked in anger upon the scribes and Pharisees. Is this what we mean? Clearly, you see, there needs to be a defining of terms. Well, first of all, we must observe that there is such a thing as righteous anger. The anger of God, which is a reality, is a righteous thing. The anger of Christ, holy anger, blistering, terrible anger. And Paul can even say to the Ephesians, "Be ye angry and sin not," which indicates that it is possible at least for men to be angry righteously without being sinful in it. And so we must make it clear at the outset that if men show anger, for example, at injustice or evil, whether social or political or personal, the Bible has no quarrel with them. We were reading this morning in Nehemiah chapter 5 how Nehemiah, the leader of God's people, was angered at the heartlessness of the Jews dealing with their fellows. Anger then can be good or bad. And this is one of the problems that we must understand. And in this connection, and as an attempt to elucidate it, let me say this. Last week, you remember, we were discussing the sin of pride and said that this is the root sin. And pride is something essentially bad and evil in itself. It is spiritual evil. And that's why it's so deadly. But there are other sins which do not belong to that category. There are sins which are not essentially and intrinsically evil in themselves, but are rather corruptions or vitiations of something originally good. To take an example, gluttony is the perversion of something originally good and God-given. Appetite. Gluttony is the corruption of appetite, but appetite is good and created by God. Lust is the corruption of something good and God-given. And in the same way, so is anger, in the derogatory sense of the term, when it is evil anger. It will help us here if we take and use another allied term, not quite the same, but often an expression of anger, namely temper. Loss of temper is normally and usually associated with anger in this derogatory sense. But temper is something good in itself. It is the element of spiritedness, if you like, in man, an essential part of man's makeup, and something which, when in right order, gives sparkle and vitality and virility to a man's life, is like fire. In its proper place and under due control, fire can be of enormous good and value to mankind. But out of its proper place and out of control, what can be more destructive? It's like that with temper. Temper, then, is an essential ingredient of the human spirit, without which a man cannot be what he was meant to be. Just as temper is an essential ingredient in good steel. And so the opposite of bad temper or of evil anger is not no temper. And this is a mistake that sometimes is made. I came across this passage just the other day, and it bears out what I'm saying. So far as one can judge, this writer says, there are persons so inert and soft that they have never been fired and never could be fired. They will take offense at nothing, not even a reflection upon their honor. They will defend no one, not even their own mother. They will be furious at nothing, not even a wrong to one of Christ's children. They will be enthusiastic about no cause, not even the cross of Christ. They smile under rebuffs. They fawn upon oppressors. They are courteous to evildoers. They have no self-respect. They have no resources of indignation. They have no flashpoint. If you had seen them only once, show resentment and strike even the feeblest blow in defense of some person, you might have respected them. As it is, you are inclined to despise this poor, unmanly stuff. Such abjects are not good-natured. They are weak-natured. They are not humble. They are cowardly. They are not masters of themselves. They are slaves to anybody. They are not sweet-tempered. They are untempered. Now, I think it's important for us to recognize this. There's a difference, a qualitative difference between good nature and weak nature. The soul that cannot at times be angry is unmanly and unwomanly. No, it's not that that we're dealing with as an opposite to anger, as an alternative to anger. What we're dealing with is that essential temper that has become corrupted and perverted and vitiated and made into an ugly, deadly thing. We're dealing with what happens when the created order in man is overthrown, and when instincts and impulses that were designed to be coordinated and under authority to the mind and intellect and will kick over the traces and do devastating harm. Now, I want you to consider with me this evening three biblical pictures which, it seems to me, underline the devilishness and deadliness of the sin of anger. And I draw your attention to these in the concern to speak well of one who can save a man to the uttermost from this sin through the power of the gospel. For let us be quite clear, there is no point in speaking about sin, however accurate and deadly the diagnosis of it may be, unless we can hold up someone who can save from sin. And the point of this exercise in these few weeks is to exalt Christ as one who can save men from sin, from the things that distort and disrupt and destroy human life and personality. The first picture is that given in Genesis chapter 4 and the story of Cain and Abel. This is the story of the first murder in history. And the first murder in history was committed because of a man's unbridled anger. And it is quite obvious from this story that anger had brooded and festered in Cain's heart until it corroded his inmost being and filled his whole horizon. He could think of nothing else but this brother who had bettered him. And then a day came when temptation and opportunity coincided. These days don't always come, you know. And we had better understand that, because if we don't, we will make some false assumptions about ourselves, and we'll assume that the evil thing that is in us can't be as bad as some people say it is. The reason why some of us don't do worse things than we do is simply because temptation and opportunity haven't happened to coincide for a time. You see, sometimes temptation is present and opportunity is lacking. And sometimes opportunity is present when the force of temptation isn't very strong. But when temptation and opportunity come together, only God can help a man. And this is how it was with Cain. Temptation and opportunity came together. And as he talked with his brother in the field, words speedily developed into blows. And he rose up against him and slew him. Now, the teaching of the scriptures here is beyond doubt. And it is that murder starts with anger. And anger can lead to murder. And this is why Christ deals with the commandment, thou shalt not kill, in the terms he does in Matthew chapter 5. Whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause is in danger of the judgment. You see, he who knew what was in man knew that the uncontrolled anger would sooner or later break out and erupt into action. Now, the thing that we need to notice is that the circumstances of this foul deed were very ordinary circumstances. This happened within a family, an ordinary family, in which relations began to become strained for one reason or another. It was not a notoriously renegade family, but a decent and indeed a religious family that practiced family worship, if we read the passages aright. Nor was Cain a profane person, as the story in Genesis chapter 4 makes plain. He was a man who had religious connections and a religious background and who was subject to religious influence. And it's perhaps here that the tragic fault lies. For his religion was not acceptable to God. It had the form of godliness, but no more. His religion had never been allowed to touch the deep springs of conduct, where actions are determined and directed. And it seems to me particularly solemn and significant that Cain was well warned by God of the danger of anger. Why art thou wroth? And why is thy countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is couching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. And one senses the urgency of the word of God in that. And here is a word that speaks down the centuries to men who are victims of this sin of anger. God says sin is couching at the door, watching for its opportunity. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. My dear friend, you whom God has brought into this church tonight, you for whom this is the big problem in your life and experience, God says to you, this is something that must be mastered in your life. Otherwise it's going to do terrible destruction. Sin is couching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. But Cain didn't believe it was as serious as all that. Joseph Parker, in his own inimitable way, wrote these words about the story of Cain. If you want to find out Cain's condition of heart, you will find it after the service which he pretended to render. You know a man best out of church. The minister sees the best side of a man, the lawyer the worst, the physician the real. If you want to know what a man's religious worship is worth, see him out of church. Cain killed his brother when church was over, and that was the exact measure of his piety. Well, when you put it like that, it's pretty devastating, isn't it? What you are, not in this service tonight, but what you are when you go home to your own fireside, that's the measure of the man. That's what God looks at. And Cain never meant it, of course. And after the first flush of passion was over, no one would have been more surprised or aghast than himself at what had happened. And don't we often say, we would never let our passions run away with us like that, which simply shows that we do not know ourselves. Sin of this kind always gets out of control. If there is one monotonous note in the newspaper reports of court cases of violent crime, this is it. We never meant it. Of course not. The fit of passion comes, and the mother lashes out on the defenseless child until it's black and blue and lacerated with bruises. She never meant it. She lost her head. And she wept when she saw the little child. But it was anger. And may God save us from the kind of psychiatric rubbish that we hear in the courts today, when psychiatrists tell us that this person is not responsible for his actions. He needs treatment, not imprisonment. There's so much rubbish today.
So much rubbish.
Of course, we know that there's a case for diminished responsibility.
But everybody who commits a violent crime is not diminished in responsibility. That sector of humanity is an extremely limited sector. And we're in danger of being overrun by this stupid, antisocial nonsense in our courts. We should thank God for these judges of the Court of Session who pass stiff sentences on crimes of violence, razor slashing. Of course, we know that there are all sorts of factors, sociological factors, heredity, environment, and so on, qualifying the behavior of men and women. But sin is sin, and it needs to be called by its proper name. There was the case of the man who, in a fit of temper, took up the cigarette stand and lashed at his wife and killed her. He never meant it. The sin of anger corrupted him. And a life lay broken and ended on the floor. That's what anger can do. We never meant it. My dear friends, it's something that we should be terribly afraid of. Anger is a killer. I never meant to go so far. All these cases are attributable to this terrible, deadly disorder. Anger is a killer. Cain slew Abel, his own brother, his young brother, in a fit of anger, uncontrollable, vicious, unbridled anger. The second picture is the picture of King Saul. Now, King Saul's experience is a good illustration of what I said earlier about right and wrong anger. For if you'd care to look at a reference in 1 Samuel chapter 11, you'll see an instance of anger which cannot be said to be evil. 1 Samuel chapter 11. This is the story of how Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh Gilead and made inroads upon the poor, dispirited people of Israel. And at verse 4, then came the messengers to Gibeah of Saul and told the tidings in the ears of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. And behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field. And Saul said, "What aileth the people that they weep?" And they told him the tidings of the men of Jabesh. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard those tidings, and his anger was kindled greatly. His anger was kindled greatly. The Spirit of God came upon this man and raised him up to be the champion and the deliverer of God's people. This is anger as it was meant to be. This is the spiritedness, the vitality in a man that makes a man of him, and is responsible, has been responsible for some of the noblest and greatest acts in history. There is a very, very different picture that we see later on. 1 Samuel chapter 18. At verse 8. Well, let's read from verse 5.
David went out whithersoever Saul sent him, and behaved himself wisely, and Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. And it came to pass, as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, that the women came out of all cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tabrets, music, instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played, Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And they said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. And it came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house, and David played with his hand as at other times, and there was a javelin in Saul's hand, and Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall with it. And 1 Samuel chapter 20 at verse 18. No, I've got the wrong reference. It's verse Jonathan, Saul's son, was knit together with David in friendship and love. And Saul saw it and was deeply jealous and angry. And Jonathan pleaded for David. And Saul was angered. His anger was kindled against his own son and miscalled him to his face. And in a fit of fury, he took up that spear that was always apparently beside his throne and hurled it at his own son, because he was consumed with anger. You all know the story of that man. The sad and tragic story of the breakup, the disintegration of a personality, through the sin of anger, and a life that had begun bright with promise and with the possibility of great destiny and the purpose of God, ended in disaster and ruin and in the most abject kind of degradation, groveling in the dust with the spiritualists and the Witch of Endor. And this man was brought down and broken by the sin of anger. And there are many lives like that. Lives that could have been something, and could have done something worthwhile and great, and they've been ruined and broken and vitiated by uncontrolled anger, coursing in their veins like a fiery poison. I wonder if I'm speaking to somebody here tonight of whom this is the literal truth. The third picture is from the New Testament. There's another kind of anger. Religious anger. Anger caused by a convicted conscience. And of course the standard example of this is Saul of Tarsus, who later confesses that he had been exceedingly mad against the Christians, persecuting them even unto strange cities, because you see he was kicking against the pricks of a goaded conscience, and it drove him mad. And the things he did, the sin of anger blossomed to its full in that man's life. Religious man that he was consumed with it, and it nearly drove him insane. Now this kind of anger is almost the ugliest and the deadliest of all.
Men, of course, will not readily recognize its origin. To them it will always be righteous indignation. The message they have heard, you see, is righteously to be condemned and criticized. The preacher has many glaring faults, etc., etc. But the real root is this conviction of sin and the anger that arises in our heart that is resisting the Spirit of God. It's this that drives men and women who are otherwise amiable, friendly, affable, to almost unheard of lengths in their vituperative opposition against the word of the gospel. Is anger your weak spot? Or let me put it this way. Have you a foul temper? Have people learned with justice to dread your outbursts? Do you find people almost going out of their way to keep you cool, because they know that if once you fly off the handle, it's going to let hell loose all around you? Is that the kind of person you are? Are you known as a person like that? And does this lie at the root of all the disorder and the unhappiness in your life? In your home, in your family? Are you, as Alexander White once said in one of his studies, are you a devil at home? Is this what conditions your attitude to others? Explains the harsh and bitter and contemptuous words, the sneers, the belittlement? How many times have you broken that heart that loves you by your outbursts of anger? Uncontrolled, ugly, vile anger and temper. Listen. Christ came into the world to save men from sin, and to save men from this sin, and to save men from themselves. Are you in this case tonight? Or may I put it this way? Might you soon be in this case if you go on the way you've been going lately? Then your need is twofold. You need a double salvation right now. First of all, you need forgiveness for the enormity of your sin, for the horror and ugliness, for the vileness of your sin. For this is something far more vile than lechery. Far more vile. And indeed far more destructive. And you need forgiveness for all the hurt and the heartbreak that you've caused. And you also need deliverance from this raging thing that's consuming you and destroying you. You need to be healed and to have that terrible power within you broken once and for all. And I have to tell you that Christ is able to do that. And if you put this thing in his hands, and let him put his hands upon it, whatever the cost may be, he'll deal with it. But you must cry to him to deal with it and to destroy it before it destroys you. Cry to him, God, be merciful to me, a sinner, and save me for Christ's sake. Save me from this terrible thing that's destroying me. That's the need of man. And I have to tell you, if you cry to God like that, he will hear you, and he will save you. I was thinking of the words of an old, old hymn, just as I came down the road to church tonight. Come, every soul by sin oppressed, there's mercy with the Lord. Only trust him. Only trust him now. He will save you. He will save you now. And if you call upon him, you will find his forgiveness. And that will be a balm in itself to the brokenness of your life. For you are ashamed of yourself, aren't you? Deeply, desperately ashamed. Ah, but not ashamed enough. If you are as deeply ashamed of it as that, you would cry to Christ to save you now. How ashamed of your sin are you? Ashamed enough to come to Christ and say, Oh Christ, break this thing in me before it breaks me forever. Do it tonight, and you go out into a new life and a new day. And may God bless you. Let us pray. Oh God, who among us can hold up our heads in face of this challenge? Who among us but has yielded again and again to this foul sin of anger and evil temper? O Christ, come to us, we beseech thee. Grant us pardon and cleansing. Grant us deliverance, that we may be made free for thy great name's sake.